Welcome to Sacrilegious Discourse.
For this is what the Sovereign Lord says.
Why do you need prophets to tell people who you are and what you want?
If you can justify everything that the God of the Bible has done, then you can justify any of your behavior.
A lot of this mentality is trickling into what is now mainstream right-wing Christianity.
I am capable of empathy greater than this God of the Bible.
This is a Bible that they tell kids. This is the good Lord. This is the good book. He is fantasizing about murder, mass murder.
Head over to sacrilegiousdiscourse.com right now to find out how to leave us a review or support us on Patreon.
Husband.
Wife.
Do you know what we're doing on this fine day?
We are doing a Q&A.
Q&A. But what are we, Saturday.
I know you know what we're doing it on, but so what are we doing it on?
Oh my God, we're doing it on Little Maddie chapter 27.
Which is it. That's the last one.
No, it's not. There's a 28th shit. Chapter.
We're so far fucking behind that I don't know which Q&A we're doing. So
Wow.
We're close to being done.
To me, is so long. This should be the final chapter. Honestly. Or this one's so long and 28 is so short that they should have taken some of chapter 27 and stuck into 28.
Right, yeah.
This is a crazy long chapter.
Just forget I said anything, everybody.
Well, anyway.
It's not it. This is definitely not it. This is going to be a long one, actually.
Yeah.
And it's not it.
It's not it. There's one more after this Q&A more. That we have to do. But
yeah.
this one is forever. It's Jesus' trial, death, and burial.
Yeah. It's also why it took so long to get this out.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
There's a lot.
My printer was still more pages?
What the fuck? What's
more?
Going on?
Are we still on the same
Jesus
chapter?
Jesus Christ, this is taking forever.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. Are you ready to do this Q&A?
Do I have any choice?
No.
Okay.
All right.
I'm ready.
Let's do it.
Okie dokie. All right. We are hopping into the Q&A for Matthew chapter 27.
Okay.
As I like to refer to him, Little Maddie.
Right.
And this chapter is really long. It's split up into five parts, the first of which is the longest. But the first part is about the death of Judas, wherein Judas regrets betraying Jesus and then kills himself.
Yeah, that was
a jump scare.
Yeah.
Came out of nowhere.
I was like, what?
Yeah. Okay, the second part is about Jesus going before Pilate, and then Jesus gets tried. And the Jerusalem leadership pushes for his execution.
Mm.
Okay? So that's a thing.
Okay.
The third part is about the suffering of Jesus.
Goddamn suffering.
He suffers.
Yeah.
Suffering succotash.
Yeah.
And then the fourth part is the actual death of Jesus. He gets crucified. He dies. And there's mockery and supernatural phenomena.
Yeah. The zombies that never got followed up on.
Yeah. Yeah. And never do.
Right.
Never do. And then the last part is real short, and that's just the burial of Jesus. No big deal.
Sure, sure.
His body gets buried by a rich dude, and the authorities then post guards at the tomb.
Which right.
I have something interesting about that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
That will be quite revealing.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's jump into that first part, the death of Judas, right?
Yeah.
After he betrays Jesus.
Right.
Our question was, that came out of fucking nowhere. What did he expect would happen?
Right.
Why did he do that?
Yeah.
Right?
What happened?
Yeah. So scholars and interpreters have proposed several possibilities.
I'm sure they have. This is a choose your own Jesus adventure.
Well, what did Jesus expect the ultimate outcome of his betrayal to be? What do you think?
Right.
It turns out that our guesses were pretty much on the nose.
Okay.
The first possibility, which I think I was the one that put this one forward, Judas actually expected Jesus to escape. So he was forwarding, he was pushing it to a head.
Yeah.
This is a really popular reconstruction, apparently. So good on me for guessing that one.
I just don't buy that because Jesus has been telling them that he's going to die.
I'm going to die.
So why would you expect somebody to escape if he's already kind of pre-planning his death?
I
I'd be like, this dude's planning on dying, so he's going to die.
But here's the thing. Besides the fact that he had been telling them, right? Just put that aside for a minute, that he had been being like, guys, I'm going to die.
Yeah.
Okay, put that aside for a minute.
Sure.
Up until that point, he had repeatedly, Jesus had been slipping away from hostile crowds. He had escaped arrest before his hour had come. Hmm. He had displayed lots of supernatural powers, according to these guys. And he had declared himself connected to God's kingdom.
Okay.
So Judas is like, yeah, right. You keep saying you're going to die, but that doesn't match up with what I've seen.
I'm just going to get me 30 silver over here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Judas may have thought, I'll force a confrontation. Jesus will do his magical Messiah thing.
Yeah.
And then everyone else will finally get to see what we've seen. They'll get to see who he really is.
Maybe Judas was testing him. Like, let's see if you really are the Son of God, motherfucker.
Could be. Then obviously Jesus doesn't fight. He doesn't summon angels.
Right.
And he doesn't incinerate the arresting party with divine lightning.
Which honestly is sus to me.
I do find that sus. He just lets himself be taken. So then Judas is like, oh shit, this for realsies happening.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he's like, I had a hand in this. That's not.
Sure did, dude.
And so then he was like, never mind, take my money back. And they're like, your money means nothing. Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
So then he's like, and kills himself.
Sure.
Okay, so that's the first possibility of why.
The other part of that is that he doesn't actually know that Jesus is going to die yet. So, like, some of that doesn't make total sense because he hasn't been tried yet.
Right.
So he
but
just,
he does see him get arrested and right. knows that he's about to be crucified.
Sure, sure.
So he knows his friend is like, oh, this just got very serious.
No, but he didn't even give him the opportunity to escape or to, you know what I'm saying?
That's
like
true.
If he was going to call the angels down or whatever, like that could still happen.
That is true. Another thing, and I think you brought this up, it was political, that Judas wanted a more aggressive political Messiah.
Sure.
And that makes a lot of sense, too. Many Jews had hoped for liberation from the Roman domination
yeah.
at the time. They were not happy that the Romans were in charge.
Right.
So maybe Judas believed that Jesus would lead a political uprising, which is kind of what they had been expecting and hoping for in him.
Especially if he pushed the issue.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so he could have been like severely disappointed when Judas refused to behave like what he expected a revolutionary would be. And so Judas was betraying him to force him to act.
Yeah.
And then that still didn't happen. And he was like, ooh.
Okay. I buy that one more.
I do, too, because that one's political.
Yeah.
So I believe that one. The third possibility is the simplest one. Judas simply got greedy.
Right.
And I don't know about that. I don't know about that.
And then immediately regretted it.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. But that's the simplest answer. He just wanted money. Matthew, Mark, and Luke, apparently, spoilers, they all give the money substantial importance, which is interesting because as the accountant, Matthew, also, you know, he's one of the ones I just named,
yeah.
gives the money substantial importance. So you would expect that from Matthew.
Yeah.
But apparently Mark and Luke do as well. Like, they're like really on exactly how much coinage was exchanged.
Right.
And John apparently goes even further and depicts Judas as a thief who steals from the group's money bag.
Hmm.
So,
wow.
Yeah.
So he was shitty all along.
Could have been.
Maybe.
Could have been.
But I mean, it's, you know, the people who are writing the history get to make up whatever story they fucking
yeah.
want to. So,
I mean,
again, I don't know how much of this to believe from their perspective.
Yeah, and it's also, like, really easy to see the bad guy in retrospect and, like, be like, yeah, I never did like that shady figure. And it's like, bullshit.
He was
part of your Tucci gang. I'm not sure I believe that after
right.
the fact that, oh, yeah, I never liked that guy.
Y'all weren't bitching about him all along, so, I
right.
mean, you know, whatever. But, I mean, it's a little, I don't know. It just strikes me as that this was written after the fact and they needed a scapegoat and
yeah.
there you go.
This yeah.
is, that's the guy.
That's the guy that betrayed him.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe Judas thought, I can get 30 pieces of silver, and whatever happens to Jesus afterward is, like, his fucking problem.
Sure.
And then Judas might not have, like, thought that far ahead to understand that the process would actually end in execution. And then he watches Jesus get all condemned, get condemned to death.
Yeah.
And realizes, oh, snap, I just sold my friend to be killed. But again...
But also he sold him to become a god. Like, right. I mean, it depends on which way you look at this, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, Jesus had literally anticipated all of this, mm-hmm. according to the gospel.
Yeah.
Right? And so his anticipation of it happening was with the understanding that he was going to be seated in heaven or whatever the fuck it is that's going on.
Yeah.
And he's going to be this Messiah type person, son right. of God, son of man, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, really, is it that big of a problem? That's my biggest issue with the whole Judas thing. Like, did it really right. cause a problem, or did it just, like, solidify the whole Jesus story? Because it just seems like a convenient story for making him Jesus.
Well, and then there's another part that I found really interesting in my research. Matthew seems super interested in creating a theological parallel between Judas and Ahithophel.
Okay.
From 2 Samuel chapters 15 through 17.
Oh, so it might actually just be like a fucking Old Testament.
It's an Old Testament comparison story.
Got it.
Yeah. So let me read you this. This is so interesting.
Okay.
And let us not forget, as we're doing this, that Matthew loved these parallels,
yeah.
right? He loved these, look what I found in the Old Testament, and I can make these exactly the same
right.
thing, you yeah. know? He also frequently portrays Jesus in Davidic terms,
right.
which what I'm about to get into. So Ahithophel was one of King David's most trusted advisors. His counsel was considered extraordinarily valuable. And the advice that Ahithophel gave was like someone asking counsel from God. Okay. Mm. So David was like, you're the best, Ahithophel. Thank you so much for all your advice.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
David's son Absalom, remember him?
I do.
Okay. He launched a rebellion against his father, remember?
Yep. Yep.
And tried to take over the kingdom. So Ahithophel betrayed David and joined Absalom's rebellion.
I remember that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, after joining David's son Absalom, Ahithophel gives Absalom this strategy for destroying David. So David had fled Jerusalem and was vulnerable. And Ahithophel says, hey, let's send a force after David immediately. Let's pursue him while he's exhausted and frightened. Let's kill him. And then the rebellion will be over and we'll have won.
Right.
Right? He's on his last legs. He's down. You got to strike, you know, sweep the leg.
Yeah.
Right? That's what they say in Karate Kid. Sweep the leg. You got to get him all, kick him while he's down.
Sure.
Okay. It's brutal, but it's strategically smart.
Right.
And if Absalom had followed the advice, David might genuinely have been defeated.
Sure.
Hushai, another trusted insider, was loyal to David, but he pretended to support David's son Absalom. So Hushai was basically a counter agent planted in the enemy camp.
Okay.
Okay. And he's giving Absalom a different strategy. He's like, wait, let's slow down. You know, because in his mind, he's like, let's give David a chance to escape. Right.
Yeah, right.
So he's like, don't rush this, Absalom. Gather a gigantic army. Take a lot of time gathering a huge army.
Yeah.
Take a few years even if you need to. Let's gather this army from all over Israel and then attack David with an overwhelming force.
Sure.
So this advice sounded way more glorious and dramatic.
Yeah.
And Absalom chose this advice from Hushai, the double agent, instead of Ahithophel. But obviously, again, Hushai's true purpose was to delay Absalom, yeah. giving David time to escape and organize.
Right.
So Ahithophel immediately realized what had happened. He saw that when Absalom rejected the best military plan, he immediately understood, we're going to lose.
Yeah.
We're going the wrong way. David's going to survive this. And when he does,
I'm fucked.
I'm fucked.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a dead man. Right. So Second Samuel says that he went home, put his house in order, and hanged himself.
Oh.
Right.
Okay.
And that's it. That is exactly what happened to Judas's shortened sequence in this chapter.
Okay.
So right. Judas is potentially being presented as another great betrayer whose betrayal ultimately fails and who then dies by suicide.
Right. Because you have to have the bad guy realize the error of the ways and and then come to a reckoning on their own.
Right.
To show how grievous it was.
Exactly. Not necessarily that they're sorry. That's another thing I'll get into, the word repent here.
Sure.
Is different from what we're thinking.
Yeah.
Okay. But the parallel stories work like this. With David, the king is betrayed by someone close to him. And with Jesus, the Messiah, who is the new Davidic king, is betrayed by someone close to him.
Sure.
Okay. With David, his betrayer helps a rebellious force trying to destroy the king. With Jesus, we've got the betrayer handing him to hostile authorities.
Okay.
With David and with Jesus, the betrayal ultimately fails. Now, with Jesus, the apparent destruction of the king fails because of the resurrection. Like, you could say that it actually succeeded because Jesus does get arrested and dies.
Right.
But where Christians are concerned, it was a success.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. Or the betrayal failed even though Jesus died because Jesus dying was good? Question mark.
Sure, sure.
But in both stories, the betrayer dies by hanging.
Got it.
So, yeah, there's that. There's the Davidic betrayal, you know?
Okay.
Which I found very interesting.
Yeah.
So it probably more of a construct than an actual thing that happens.
Which is not surprising at all.
In any way whatsoever.
Yeah.
So let's get into the word repent. It's not the same use of the word as what we're thinking of. Like, Judas's repentance is described with metamelomai, which is something closer to regret and remorse and changing one's mind. Not like, I've seen the error of my ways and I'm having a come back to Jesus moment.
Sure.
Like, it's not the same verb that we use for the broader concept of turning one's life around.
Okay.
It's not like, I've now experienced Christian repentance and am, you know, returning to God. It simply means, oh, God damn, yikes on a bike. I made a terrible mistake. That sucks. Like, that kind of repentance.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's really important to say because we don't want to get that mixed up with Judas was actually coming back to his friend and, you know, like now he's a saint because he saw the error of his ways.
Sure.
He merely realized that he fucked up.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's not the same.
Okay.
Like, it matters.
Right.
To me, I mean, intent matters, right?
Yeah.
So, I also wanted to talk again about the term Potter's Field. And we covered this when we were going through the Old Testament. But the term Potter's Field refers to land, because when Judas realized what he did, right, he went back and he was like, just kidding, here, take the money back, guys. Jewish leaders, take the money back. And they were like, that's nothing to us.
Yeah.
What the fuck are you talking about?
Right.
And he's like, just keep it, and throws it at them.
Sure.
And they're like, well, betraying Jesus was fine. We don't mind giving out blood money. That's perfectly ethical. But we can't use this blood money now for anything good in the church.
Right.
So we'll just create a Potter's Field.
Okay.
That's what we'll do. So that there's a little bit of like irony in that story that we kind of glossed over because we didn't realize, like, that's really funny, actually.
Yeah.
They were like, blood money? What are we supposed to do with blood money? Like, my guys, you're the one that gave
them. You paid it out, yeah.
You made it be blood money.
Right.
So there's that. So when they do this Potter's Field, that means that it's land associated with potters where the clay had been excavated or where the land was really poor and unusable for agriculture.
Okay.
And Potter's Fields often became associated with the burial of people who were poor, unknown, unclaimed, or otherwise unable to afford burial.
Sure.
So they're like just un unnamed graves.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Matthew says the priests used Judas's blood money to buy a field, quote, as a burial place for foreigners. A foreigner here likely means a non-local person or a resident alien who died in Jerusalem and didn't have a family burial plot.
Okay.
Which is really interesting because later, Jesus, his plot breaks.
Yeah.
And he has to get a new burial plot by a rich man.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting little connection there.
Sure.
Potter's Field basically becomes the cemetery for people who don't have anyone else to bury them. And that's why the term survived into later usage that we still talk about today. That's a Potter's Field.
Yeah.
Even today, a Potter's Field can mean a cemetery or burial ground for indigent, like homeless or unhoused people who are just unidentified, unclaimed bodies, just unmarked graves.
Okay.
So we still have Potter's Fields today.
Yeah.
Which is sad and interesting.
Sure, for sure. Yeah.
So I'm going to read verses 9 and 10, which has a little bit of an error in it. This is interesting.
Okay. And
because we don't have the Bible memorized, we did not catch this error
right.
as we were reading it.
Right.
So verses 9 and 10. Then what was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. They took the 30 pieces of silver, the price set on him by the people of Israel, and they used them to buy the potter's field as the Lord commanded me. Here's the thing. What he meant to say was Zechariah 11, not so much Jeremiah,
I see.
Jackass.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So here's Zechariah 11, okay?
Yeah.
Verses 7 through 14. So I shepherded the flock marked for slaughter, particularly the oppressed of the flock. Then I took two staffs, and I called one favor and the other union, and I shepherded the flock. In 1 month, I got rid of the three shepherds. The flock detested me, and I grew weary of them and said, I will not be your shepherd. Let the dying die and the perishing perish. Let those who are left eat one another's flesh. Then I took my staff called favor and broke it, revoking the covenant I had made with all the nations. It was revoked on that day, and so the oppressed of the flock who were watching me knew it was the word of the Lord. I told them, if you think it best, give me my pay, but if not, keep it. So they paid me 30 pieces of silver. And the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, the handsome price at which they valued me. So I took the 30 pieces of silver and threw them to the potter at the house of the Lord.
I remember that.
Then yeah. I broke my second staff called union, breaking the family bond between Judah and Israel.
Interesting. Okay.
So that whole section is definitely what he meant.
Yeah. But and this is held up for thousands of years as just... Yeah, we're just going to let that error stand in the Bible.
Yeah.
Because it was written by people who weren't math. I don't understand the justification for allowing that to stand, I guess.
Well, scholars today will say that either he made a misquote or in copying over and translating early scribes.
Yeah.
Just mistranslated or made the error. Either way.
But it's still an error.
It's an error.
And it's people like to say that the Bible does not err.
Right.
You know, and I'm like, the fuck it doesn't.
So I'm going to read Jeremiah chapter 19, verses 1 through 13. And it kind of a little bit maybe goes into what he was maybe talking about.
Okay.
But let's just assume no.
Sure. Okay.
This is what the Lord says. Go and buy a clay jar from a potter. Take along some of the elders of the people and the priests and go out to the valley of Ben Hinnom near the entrance of the potsherd gate.
Okay.
There proclaim the words I tell you and say, hear the word of the Lord, you kings of Judah and people of Jerusalem. This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. Listen, I'm going to bring a disaster on this place that will make the ears of everyone who hears of it tingle. For they have forsaken me and made this a place of foreign gods. They have burned incense in it to gods that neither they nor their ancestors nor the kings of Judah ever knew. And they have filled this place with the blood of the innocent. They have built the high places of Baal to burn their children in the fire as offerings to Baal. Something I did not command or mention, nor did it enter my mind. So beware, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when people will no longer call this place Topheth or the Valley of Ben-Hinnom, but the Valley of Slaughter. In this place I will ruin the plans of Judah and Jerusalem. I will make them fall by the sword before their enemies at the hands of those who want to kill them. And I will give their carcasses as food to the birds and the wild animals. I will devastate this city and make it an object of horror and scorn. All who pass by will be appalled and will scoff because of all its wounds. I will make them eat the flesh of their sons and daughters. They will eat one another's flesh because their enemies will press the siege so hard against them to destroy them. Then break the jar while those who go with you are watching and say to them, this is what the Lord Almighty says. I will smash this nation and this city just as this potter's jar is smashed and cannot be repaired. They will bury the dead in Topheth until there is no more room. This is what I will do to this place and to those who live there, who live here, declares the Lord. I will make this city like Topheth. The houses in Jerusalem and those of the kings of Judah will be defiled like this place, Topheth, and all the houses where they burned incense on the roofs to all the starry hosts and poured out drink offerings to other gods.
Yeah, that has nothing to do with
there was that. Jars.
Right.
There was a broken jar.
Yeah, it was definitely, that's definitely wrong. In the,
right?
That was wrong.
That was wrong, yeah.
Because the Zechariah thing was much closer and more relevant.
Much more relevant.
So that was wrong.
Here's another place from Jeremiah in chapter 32, verses 6 through 9. Jeremiah said, the words of the Lord came to me. Hanamel, son of Shalum, your uncle, is going to come to you and say, buy my field at Anathoth, because as nearest relative, it is your right and duty to buy it. Then, just as the Lord had said, my cousin Hanamel came to me in the courtyard of the guard and said, buy my field at Anathoth in the territory of Benjamin, since it is your right to redeem it and possess it, buy it for yourself. I knew that this was the word of the Lord, so I bought the field at Anathoth from my cousin Hanamel and weighed out for him 17 shekels, which is 7 ounces, or about 200 grams of silver.
But not 30 pieces of silver.
Not 30. Yeah. Right. So, yeah.
Okay. And so, and also still has nothing to do with
right.
what was being talked about.
Exactly.
Whereas Zechariah did.
Zechariah was so fucking relevant that there's no question that that was an error.
Right. Which is funny insofar as the people that say there's not errors in the Bible. There's literally one in the first chapter of the New Testament.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, okay.
Yeah.
And like yeah. specifically
mm-hmm.
an error.
So yeah, so you meant Zechariah, jackass.
Right.
Is
yeah.
what you say.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that ends the first section. Okay.
Okay.
Then we get into the second section. Okay. Part two of mm-hmm. five.
Yeah.
Jesus before Pilate, where Jesus is tried and Jerusalem leadership pushes for his execution.
Okay.
Okay. So Pilate is asking all these questions to Jesus, right? And he gets greatly impressed when Jesus refuses to answer.
Okay.
And we were like, why is that impressive? But we'll get there. Okay. First, he's like, dude, seriously, are you fucking claiming to be king? What even? And Jesus is like, if you say so,
right.
sure, whatevs. Right. And then Pilate is like, these people are accusing you of several crimes. Are you going to say anything? And then Jesus doesn't say anything. And Pilate's like, right? So that's their whole like conversation.
Yeah.
Okay. Pilate is apparently confused because Jesus is accused of political crimes, but he does not behave like a political revolutionary. He just sure. stands there.
Right.
Doing nothing. Saying nothing.
Yeah, I mean, like a political revolutionary would be like, damn the man. Yeah, I'm king. Whatever. Fuck you.
My people. Blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. But he's just like, whatever you say, brah.
Sure.
Yeah. And so then after that, Jesus largely stops answering at all. So this is partly a literary choice that Matthew is making. Matthew wants Jesus to resemble the suffering servant of Isaiah chapter 53. Mm. Like a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he's allowing himself to be shorn. He's the you know, silent sufferer.
It's so funny how much, I mean, literally almost every bit of Matthew was stolen from something in the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. And or related to it, or
copied from Mark, but then stuffed with the Hebrew Bible.
Yeah.
Bullshit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like it's the whole book is kind of absurd.
It's kind of very absurd, and you can take kind of out of it, so that all we're left with is very absurd.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So then we move on to Pilate hoping to release Jesus. And he's inquiring of the Jews whether they would rather have Jesus or Barabbas released.
Right.
When he receives a message from his wife to have nothing to do with this wicked business. Now, we need to talk about the name Barabbas.
Okay.
Apparently, it is very interesting.
I see.
Yeah. I was like, what? It's very weird. Okay. The word bar, or the part of his name bar, means son. Abba means father. So Barabbas literally means son of the father.
Okay.
So we know Jesus is, you know, what Matthew calls son of the father.
Yeah.
So here's the really weird part. Some ancient manuscripts refer to Barabbas as Jesus Barabbas.
Yeah.
So Pilate may have actually been asking, which Jesus do you want me to release? Jesus Barabbas or Jesus called the Messiah, right? And so the crowd chooses Jesus, son of the father, to be released rather than Jesus, the son of the father.
Hmm. Okay.
Isn't that something?
That is something.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, what is it about that article that makes all the difference?
That could change the whole interpretation of that section.
It really could if we understood that better.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
So there's clearly more to that Barabbas guy. We don't know any more about it here. I don't know what the other Gospels tell us. I have not looked at those because I try really hard to refrain from going into the other chapters knowing more than I know, since I want our read to be fresh.
But it would be interesting to dig into that specifically at some point. Like, not tonight, because, you know.
No, obviously.
There's so much. But
this is definitely, like, I want to make a note to circle back around to this, regardless of whether or not the Gospels do.
Right. Yeah.
Because that,
it's worth pursuing a little.
There's got to be more there. Whether the Gospels touch on it or not, there's got to be more there.
Yeah.
So there are also many later traditions that suggest the name may have been uncomfortable to Christians, and that's why some scribes drop the Jesus from the Jesus Barabbas.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they're like, do you want Jesus or Barabbas?
Got it.
Instead of Jesus or Jesus Barabbas.
Right.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
But but I thought it was interesting that they were both Jesus. You know?
Yeah, like
they were both Jesus.
Yeah.
So, like, that's really weird.
Mm-hmm.
But that in and of itself, and what you just said there,
mm-hmm.
makes me think that it is maybe both Jesus.
Yeah.
And that was more of a statement than it actually seems like, possibly.
Right.
And again, something worth digging into at some point.
There's clearly some kind of verbal wordplay that we're not getting the full picture of, you and I.
Right.
And there's clearly something else happening in that story that we're not getting.
Right.
Okay. But moving on from whatever the fuck his name is.
Yeah.
Pilate realizes that the chief priests have handed Jesus over because either they, the Jewish leaders, are jealous of Jesus, or they're threatened by him.
Sure.
Because Jesus has attracted large crowds. He's publicly challenged religious authorities. He's attacked the temple establishment, not the Roman.
Right.
And he's disrupted the temple marketplace, not Roman stuff, just the Jewish stuff.
Yeah.
Right? And he's claimed enormous religious authority.
Okay.
So Pilate realizes all this and he's like, fuck me. This isn't about Roman law at all.
Yeah.
I hate this. This is about these fucking Hebrew people that are doing their fucking Jewish thing, and they've involved us and this sucks. I hate everything about this. I want nothing to do with it.
Right.
And he's like, these jackwagons are using me and my court to help them get rid of a religious and political rival. I fucking hate you.
Sure.
Why are you putting me in this spot?
Right. Right. Right.
Unfortunately, despite recognizing all of this, he still authorizes Jesus's execution.
Yeah.
And there's questions about whether he had the authority for sure. Did he have the power behind that authority?
Political will.
To stop what was happening?
Yeah.
I mean, it looked like the Romans in the audience were like, hey, the Jewish people don't like them, so we don't either.
The way that it's written, they definitely, the people that were there at the execution, the trial and all that, weren't fans of Jesus.
Right.
Or at least at the time when this was happening, they were not acting like fans of Jesus.
Right.
So
the Jewish leaders definitely had drummed up enthusiasm to have this guy put down.
Yeah, and so in the political will in the moment is to go along with whatever.
Right.
You know, like,
I don't know how precarious Pilate's little throne was.
Well, he's definitely managing an area that is not overly friendly to him, because there's people that want a rebellion.
Uh-huh.
So, like, you have to walk a fine line of appeasing and control.
That's what I'm saying. Right? He had the authority. I don't know that he had the actual ability to turn this a different direction.
Right, right.
And From what Matthew's saying, it looks like he did kind of try.
Sure.
Did he try enthusiastically? No. But there's some indication that he did resent being put in that position, though.
Sure.
And that he was not a stupid man.
Yeah.
You know, so he knew what was happening. He knew he was being used, and he wasn't happy about it. And that's why he washed his hands of it.
Right.
And said, fine, the blood is on y'all, not me. I'm going to do what you want, but I'm not going down as the guilty party here.
Sure.
Which is interesting, because he doesn't go down as the guilty party. Who bears the brunt of the guilt thousands of years later?
Jewish people.
Yeah. So the multitude, influenced by the chief priests and elders, demand the release of Barabbas and the crucifixion of Jesus. And we asked, hold on. Jesus had so many followers.
Right.
Where the fuck were they?
Yeah.
Where the fuck were they, and why weren't they there demanding his release?
Right.
Matthew had previously given us the impression that Jesus has enormous crowds following him, disciples traveling with him, admirers from all over shouting, Hosanna, Hosanna in the highest.
Right.
And people amazed by all of his many, many miracles.
Yeah, but none to be found, apparently.
Right. They suddenly just vanished. Yeah,
right.
They just vanish. Now, Peter obviously follows him.
Sure,
and
but
then
he
denies
took
him.
Off. Right.
Yeah. I mean, fair if he's the only fucking one there.
Yeah.
I don't
blame
him. I mean,
he also cut off somebody's ear. So, I mean, you know, probably not in good favor himself.
Right. Exactly. Judas betrays him. The disciples have already fled, and the crowd demands execution. So there's a few different things that might explain this. I'm not sure how I feel about any of this, but I'm going to go through them nonetheless.
Right.
Because we did ask the question.
Sure.
Okay. These aren't necessarily the same crowds. Like, the crowds that were following Jesus are not the same crowds that are demanding that Jesus be crucified.
I mean, obviously.
Right.
Right. I mean, I think that's pretty obvious.
Yeah.
But it begs to be asked, where the fuck are those crowds that were following him everywhere?
I guess they're back home.
Right, but why? Like, why did they follow him everywhere except for to his death?
I don't think that they were following him. I don't think crowds were following him.
I guess.
From town to town? Like, I think that he passed through towns, and they might have heard tale of him coming ahead. Like, they might have heard about him, and then Jesus passes through their town, and It's kind of like some singer today goes on tour. Yeah, he's got a few groupies that go, like, with him across the United States and then, you know, on his European tour.
Sure. Yeah.
But for the most part, like, I don't know, like when Tom Petty came through town, we didn't follow Tom Petty all over the place. We stayed right here where we live.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's what the majority of people do.
Right.
Even today. And we definitely have the ability to travel much easier than the people back then.
True.
So I think that Jesus was the one traveling, and they may have heard about him coming to town, but I don't think they followed him out of town. Maybe one or two, but I don't think he had crowds.
Yeah.
I think he had crowds at his events, much like a singer has crowds at a concert.
I feel like this is an event.
Mm-hmm.
He's being tried. He's being killed. You know, like, this is an event.
But this isn't the event that they signed up for.
Right. Maybe he hadn't made his splash in whatever town this is they're doing the trial in. It's Jerusalem, isn't it?
I think.
Or something. Like, so, it just doesn't, to me, it just still doesn't track.
No, I agree. But the crowd in this chapter may have consisted primarily of people brought together by the chief priests and elders.
Right.
Right. This particular crowd.
It's a curated crowd.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Right. I mean, you could tell that it was put together. Right. Like, that's what I said before I even read this part, that the church leaders definitely drummed up all of this, you know, interest and enthusiasm to see Jesus crucified. So they were going around gathering enthusiastic people to be here for this event.
Right.
So Matthew specifically says the leaders persuaded the crowds.
Yeah.
And then from there, it's not necessarily that the exact same 5,000 people that, you know, Jesus fed or cured or whatever suddenly decided to kill him. Like, right. We do see where crowds can be swayed, but that would be
No, I never ridiculous. Assumed that was what was happening. Like, that was never part of my thought process.
I didn't think one way or the other. I just thought the people, right? The people love him. Now the people hate him. So in my head, I was like, why are the people that love him speaking up? I don't understand.
Right. No, that was my biggest concern, was like, where are all of those people that do follow him around and do love him and do all these things? You know, like, they've been there the whole time until now.
It's like, this is a Trump rally and not a fill in the blank with whichever progressive you love party.
Right.
And so we're like, but where are the progressives to yell, maybe not murder.
Right.
Maybe not stick your boot in somebody's ass. Maybe not nuke them till they glow.
I mean, if we're to take the disciples and the apostles' reaction of, like, not being there for this as an indicator, probably a lot of those people were anti-Roman and probably didn't want to show up.
Right.
You know?
Like, yeah.
They may have good reason not to be there.
I'm not going inside, you know, where I have
enemy
ground. Like, you would be walking on to enemy ground because this is literally a Roman court.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they had reason not to be there. Another thing is that the arrest itself happened at night, and Judas is arrested outside the city.
Jesus?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Jesus is arrested. Thank you. I will continue to do that. So please pay very close attention to whether I say Judas or Jesus and correct me every time, because I don't hear myself when I'm doing it wrong.
Yeah.
I know what I mean, but, like, I don't hear myself.
Right.
So continue to correct me.
Yeah.
Thank you. Carry on.
Yeah.
So anyway, the arrest happened at night outside the city where Jesus is arrested.
Sure.
Okay. So his public supporters may not even know what happened until much later.
Got it.
Because, you know, it was kind of like happening on the DL or whatever.
Yeah.
So that I hadn't even considered that.
Yeah.
His followers obviously were terrified. The authorities have arrested their leader, and his closest disciple has already demonstrated how dangerous it is to be associated with Jesus.
Okay.
If you're a random former blind person or a former demon possessed person or a formerly, like, dead person that was brought back to life.
Yeah.
Like, think about this, right? Are you going to go stand outside the Roman governor's headquarters and shout, "Hey, let him go. He healed me, motherfuckers."
Right.
Or are you going to, like, silently think, "I would prefer not to be crucified on this fine day. And I am going to take my fresh eyeballs that can now see and go home."
Right.
So, I mean, that goes to the going into enemy territory, you know, avoiding it.
Yep.
And then also this is the weakest thing. Ancient crowds are fluid. Matthew's crowds are not a permanent political constituency. They're just whoever is present at the time in any one given area.
I guess, but that's not how it's portrayed with Jesus.
Right.
Like, part of the reason they're executing him is because he's
able to raise large crowds.
Right, right.
Yeah. So. But he had not raised this crowd himself. The Jewish leaders did.
Sure.
So that makes all the difference.
Right.
And I forgot about the fact that he was arrested that night, and he was arrested outside the city.
Yeah, I'm going to go... Best thing I can use as an explanation, a curated crowd. They brought their own...
A curated crowd on top of political logistics.
Right, right.
I think between the two of those.
Yeah.
You know? So Pilate attests his innocence and tries to avoid responsibility for Jesus' fate. And the people then make themselves and their posterity responsible for Jesus' blood.
Mm.
Okay? Pilate's wife sends this message. Have nothing to do with this righteous man. For today, I have suffered greatly because of a dream about him. And then she disappears from the Bible forever and we never hear about her ever again.
Right.
Okay? Which it's interesting that there are a few times that women are preserved in the book of Matthew.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the dog, you know, the lady who he's like, you're a dog. And then she's like, even dogs have to eat crumbs. And then he's like, ah, you got me. I guess you and yours can have some dinner too. Okay.
Right.
And then, there's the lady that dumps perfume on him and anoints him.
Yeah.
So there's like all these different women that perform important acts towards Jesus. Matthew doesn't record their names, but he does record that there are women performing important acts.
Sure.
That is just worth noting as a feminist.
Sure.
It's not good enough.
Right.
But the fact that it's present at all should be noted.
Right.
So
right.
There, I noted it. All right. So there's a few reasons that Matthew probably includes her in the first place. Okay.
Okay.
The first one, another witness to Jesus's innocence. And, you know, it's a magical one. So that's awesome, right? Because she had the dream, right?
Right.
Throughout this narrative, Matthew piles up people acknowledging or discovering Jesus's innocence. Like Judas says, I have betrayed innocent blood. And Pilate's wife says, he's a righteous man. And Pilate even says, I am innocent of this man's blood. And later in this chapter, we get the centurion saying, truly, this was God's son.
Yeah.
So he's just like trying to make a case of all of these various people saying Jesus definitely was innocent.
Got it.
Okay. And, you know, the more people that say that, the more we're supposed to believe it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So here's the second one. And this has more to do with magic. I love magic.
Okay.
Okay. Dreams are very important in the book of Matthew. Matthew loves to show divine communication through dreams.
Oh, yeah.
Joseph received dreams,
right? How many times did God speak to Joseph through an angel in his dreams?
Yep. Yeah. Your little virgin 12-year-old that you married, she's pregnant, but still marry her anyways. And then name the baby Jesus. And it's great. This is perfect. You're going to love this. I love this for you. Don't move here. Move to that city instead.
Right.
Ooh, right?
Yep.
The Magi are warned in dreams.
Yeah.
Like, don't go here, go there, travel, follow the star, follow your nose, it always knows. Joseph is warned about Herod in a dream.
Yeah.
Again, you know, with the...
Well, that was part of the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Pilate's wife receives a dream, right? So we love to see the God sending out his angelic communicators to reach down magically and communicate to us because God is too busy to do it him damn self.
Through dreams where no one else can witness what had happened.
So yes, very
convenient.
So convenient.
Yeah.
So the dream probably functions as another warning from the divine realm.
Sure.
Okay. So there's that. The third reason, Matthew is increasingly shifting blame, and this becomes very problematic. Matthew's portrayal tends to emphasize that Pilate recognizes Jesus' innocence, Pilate's wife warns him, and then Pilate washes his hands.
Yeah.
So that literary pattern makes Pilate look, in a literary sense, less responsible. And the Jewish leadership and crowd is all the ones responsible for Christ's death, right? Who kills Jesus? I mean, Pilate didn't want it. It was them Jews,
right?
Historically, this is highly suspicious because Roman prefects absolutely did not need a Jerusalem crowd's permission to execute someone.
Right.
They could do whatever the fuck they wanted, whenever the fuck they wanted.
Yeah.
Pilate had the authority, right?
Right.
Later Christian tradition often pushes this even further, portraying Pilate as almost innocent of everything.
Wow.
Like, he had nothing to do with it. He was barely even there that day.
It's so interesting how much they want to blame the Jewish people.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
it started in Matthew, and I've pulled it out a couple times.
Oh, yeah. No, they've been going down that road, mm-hmm. and it turns in, like, it ends up in modern times being something very ugly.
Yes.
With regard to how that pans out, mm-hmm. you know, obviously. But
Matthew definitely planted the seeds there, and it feels very intentional.
Right.
Like, I don't care for it. And I said it at the time. He is saying that the Jewish people are doing this, and it makes it seem like, even though this happened after Jesus's death, it makes it seem like he definitely had an agenda, that he saw that this quote unquote Jewish sect was already very separate from the Jews that we were reading about in the Old Testament.
Yeah.
This was, maybe we don't call them Christians yet because obviously they didn't refer to themselves as Christian yet, but they were very clearly, or at least Matthew was writing as though they very clearly saw themselves as not those Jews.
Right.
And that's gross.
Yeah.
To me.
Yeah.
Like, just planting the seeds for that wicked thought is where we are today.
Yeah.
So Pilate washes his hands, and that's another Hebrew Bible callback. He theatrically washes his hands and says, I'm innocent of this man's blood. Okay. And this echoes Deuteronomy chapter 21, where the elders of a community would wash their hands after an unsolved murder and declare, our hands did not shed this blood. So where we got the, I wash my hands of this.
Yeah.
I mean, that is clear.
No, I actually remember covering that back,
yep.
way back.
But yep.
Yeah.
Yep. So Pilate is performing that theatrically in front of everybody. He's performing this biblical ritual saying, this is not my murder. I wash my hands of it. This is nothing to do with me.
Sure.
And it's kind of funny because he's literally a Roman governor and he's about to authorize the execution. So it's definitely his murder.
Yeah.
And yeah, the Jewish leaders wanted this to happen, but Pilate had every recourse. He could have said, you know what, let's table this and pin it for another day.
I think that the New Testament is very blatantly trying to separate themselves from the traditional Jewish groups.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like, and it might have started more innocently than it ended up being, but that is, they're definitely trying to draw a hard line between
mm-hmm.
Judaism and the New
Jews.
Testament, the new Jews, the Christians.
The different Jews,
yeah.
the other ones.
Right.
The quote unquote better ones.
Right.
And I'm like, nah, y'all ain't better.
Yeah, and I think that's what this is. They're just trying to draw that line very heavily to make sure that there is a distinction.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm. Matthew chapter 27, verse 25 is one of the most, I'm sorry, chapter, let me start over. Let me just start over.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Do that.
This is one of the most historically dangerous verses in the New Testament.
Okay.
Okay, verse 25
sure.
of Matthew 27.
Got it.
Okay. The crowd says, his blood be on us and our children. And this verse has been used for centuries to justify anti-Semitism and collective punishment of Jews, which goes right to what we were just saying.
Right.
Okay.
And that's not to excuse what the Jewish people are doing to Palestinians today.
Right.
But the Jewish people have been through their own horrors in recent-ish history.
Right.
So.
It's all convoluted and nuanced.
Yes.
Historically and textually, Matthew is not recording the eternal oath of every Jewish person here. The scene concerns just a particular crowd within the story, and the statement only appears in the book of Matthew, not the other gospels.
Interesting.
Yeah. So the idea that later generations are literally guilty for their ancestors' alleged actions
comes from this.
And it's morally horrifying.
Yeah.
Because that's not what was supposed to be.
Right.
And
well, and I find it very difficult to wrap my head around an all-loving God, a Jesus, a forgiving of sins, mm-hmm. who is blaming an entire culture.
Right.
Like, oh, they all fucking suck. They killed this dude. And again, you have to sit there and go, but you were going to, that was all part of the plan, my guy.
Yeah.
Like, who gives a fuck?
Right.
Like, you died because you were going to die, and now you're dead, and then you got resurrected. Wow. Rough day, man.
Sucks to be you, ?
Yeah.
We should all be so lucky.
Yeah.
Right? Like, yeah. Tell it to the people in Gaza.
Most of us don't get resurrected. Just saying, yeah. Just die.
Yeah. So this is especially important because the chapter has been used in Christian history to shift responsibility away from the Roman state and onto, quote unquote, the Jews.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
It's historically bizarre given that it was literally the Romans and their soldiers, the centurions, that crucified him. Yeah.
Like, and that's, you see that in every fucking depiction.
Right.
You see the centurions, they're the ones bringing him through the line with the cross on his back.
Yeah.
They're the ones spearing him with the, spear.
They fought over his clothes.
Right. Like, this is what you see, and yet.
And yet.
The culprit is the Jewish people.
Right. So Pilate definitely, as we've said multiple times now, had the political authority to stop the execution. The Roman soldiers carried it out. And most importantly, crucifixion itself was specifically a Roman, not a Jewish type of punishment.
Sure. Yeah.
So there's that.
Right.
Okay. So now we move on to part three, the suffering of Jesus.
All right.
Okay. So Barabbas is released.
Was there succotash involved?
Barabbas succotash.
Suffering succotash.
I made that joke earlier, and you looked at me like I was an idiot. Now you make it, and I'm...
Well, it's much more funny when I say it, so I mean...
That is true. So, our question was, does Barabbas have more of a backstory? And yeah, we've already talked about his name a little bit. The other Gospels apparently do give us more, so that's, again, why I didn't go into him. But yeah. I want to circle back to Barabbas.
Sure.
At some point.
Right.
Like, he's definitely a special episode.
Yeah.
Okay. So Barabbas is released. Christ is scourged, which is a customary prelude to the crucifixion.
Okay.
And then soldiers strip Jesus. They clothe him with a scarlet robe and they crown him with thorns. Jesus is then beaten, mocked, and variously insulted.
Okay.
Okay. Then we talk about on the way to Golgotha, which in Latin is the same word as Calvary.
Okay.
Which I didn't know.
Yeah.
So on their way there, in this particular version, Simon is compelled to bear his cross.
Okay.
To carry his cross.
Right.
To carry his burden.
Yeah.
Right? Like we use that as a phrase now, to bear your cross.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Jesus is then given vinegar mingled with gall to drink, and Jesus is crucified, and the Roman soldiers at the crucifixion of Jesus cast lots for his clothing. Okay, so Golgotha, which is where they're heading, means place of the skull.
Okay.
And the word Calvary comes from the Latin word for skull. Okay.
Okay.
So that's what that is.
Yeah.
We don't know why they named that. Let's go to the town of Skull. Let's go to Skull Town. We don't know what that means. We don't know where that comes from. But some popular theories include maybe the hill or the site looked like a skull. Could be. Castle Grayskull.
Sure.
I have the power. maybe skulls were somehow associated with that place, which, I mean, if this is a place where they executed a lot of people once they got there...
Yeah.
That kind of makes sense, right?
Right.
Or maybe it was just a traditional place name. Skull Hill, let's go up there.
Sure.
I don't fucking know.
Right.
Neither do they. And that's ultimately what it comes to. Well, I don't fucking know.
There's a lot of not knowing in the Bible.
I love the guesses, though. They're so fun. They're like, maybe it's this. But it's also like, but I don't fucking know is your answer. Right. But they can't just say, I don't fucking know.
No, that's part of the problem too, right? Everybody has their own actual answer mm-hmm. to the things that people don't know.
Right.
And I'm sorry, but you can't, you're just making, like when you get to this point, when you've read this much of the Bible, when you've done this much research, you and I both know these fuckers are just guessing most of the way through for a lot of this. Like there's so many jumping off points that you have to create your own version of the story for it to be correct if you want it to be correct. Because the truth is that there's so many problems, it would never be correct.
Right.
They're just a bunch of fucking questions.
I wish the researchers would say, here's some guesses, 1, 2, 3, and 4. But at the end of the day, we don't fucking know.
Right.
Like, I wish that that was... Instead, they say, well, we don't fucking know, but here's some guesses.
Yeah.
And then they leave you with the guesses, and then you get to walk away with the guesses in your head instead of the last sentence should be the one that sticks, which is, here's some guesses, but at the end of the day, we don't fucking know is what you should walk away with.
Right. Yeah.
So it's all in the phrasing. Yeah. You know? So we get to choose our answer.
And it's hard to build a religion, though, around I don't know.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That's why I don't build a religion. I don't mind not knowing. I'm comfortable sitting in the discomfort of not knowing.
Yeah. I think it's a good place to be.
Yep. Yep. People who are working through OCD would tell you that as well.
Right.
Yeah. All right. So then two thieves are crucified with Jesus, one on his right, one on his left. And they make fun of them too. Nanny, nanny, boo boo, stick your head in doo doo as they're dying on their own
crosses. Again, I call bullshit on that. Like, you're literally dying on the cross. You're not going to spend a moment to make fun of Jesus.
Listen, if they were in the same cell, like we hear about people in jail making fun of each other in jail, that makes sense because they're not like currently dying themselves. But these folks are also aspirating.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, apparently, the way that they would crucify them, when they hung them by, putting the nails in their wrists and stuff, the way that they hung, slowly, they would not be able to gain breath, their own body weight.
Yeah.
Right. So these people are suffering to breathe, too.
Right.
And they're wasting their final breaths, making fun. To laugh
at Jesus.
Accuse, mock, and insult. Motherfucker.
Right.
I just don't buy it.
Right.
So the two thieves crucified with Jesus, however, may have been more than simple thieves.
Okay.
The Greek term lestai could refer more broadly to bandits, brigands, insurgents, or political rebels. Yeah. So in the political climate of Roman Judea, the word, thief, which again, we're going with the Greek lestai, which I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that. But that word could carry a much more dangerous implication than just like purse snatchers.
Okay.
Which would make sense why they're up there on the cross. They did something more than just steal somebody's shit, right?
Sure.
They didn't just break into a house and steal a TV, okay? They were up there for a big fucking reason. So Jesus being crucified between them reinforces the political accusation that this is just another quote unquote dangerous rebel against Rome.
Got it.
So they put all of their Roman rebels, rabble rousers, they put them all up there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. On Skull Hill.
Right.
On Skull Mountain.
Right.
Which is so interesting to me. Like, I want to know more about those guys.
Right.
We might hear about more about them in the other gospels.
Possibly.
Yeah. So, okay. Now we move into part 4, the death of Jesus.
Yeah.
Jesus gets crucified and dies amid all that fucking mockery.
It was a shocker to me.
I never saw it coming. And then we get some supernatural phenomena. Okay.
Right. So this was some bullshit. I was not expecting this.
It was some bullshit.
It really was.
Yeah.
I was, this one caught me off guard.
Right.
Yeah.
So first, an unusual and awful darkness falls on the land. This is midday, so clearly this is bullshit and didn't happen.
I mean, it might have been a big cloud or something.
Anyways. And then we get Jesus crying out to his father in agony.
Yeah.
He's offered vinegar to drink again, and we get the death of Jesus.
Right.
Okay. So about 3 in the afternoon. Oh, I'm going to read verses 46 and 47.
Okay.
About 3 in the afternoon. Remember, we made fun of that. About 3, huh?
Not
may have been 2:55, may have been 3:05, somewhere around there.
They didn't have digital clocks,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, so about 3 in the afternoon
right.
or so.
Yeah.
Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?
Right.
When some of those standing there heard this, they said, he's calling Elijah. Ring, 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 ring. Send Elijah home. So, again, that means, my God, why have you forsaken me?
Yeah.
The Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani is a linguistic mashup. Okay, the opening, Eli, is my God. So he does say, my God, my God.
Yeah.
But that is Hebrewish. Okay?
Okay.
While sabachthani is Aramaic.
Hmm.
The exact linguistic situation is complicated because Matthew and Mark preserve slightly different forms.
Oh.
So we're going to see it a little bit differently when we get to Mark.
Interesting.
Okay? Matthew, what we're, you know, currently going through,
yeah,
seems to be preserving a phrase Jesus spoke in the Aramaic / Hebrew speaking environment of first century Judea rather than simply giving us a Greek sentence.
Yeah.
Which that's interesting.
Right, right.
Matthew's wording combines the languages of Jesus's world, but the important thing is that the cry is preserved in a Semitic language quotation rather than simply being translated into Greek.
Okay.
Like we should or would expect.
Right, right.
Like he lets that sit as it was.
Got it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Eli, moving on, sounded similar to a call for Elijah.
Right.
Which was known in Hebrew as Eliyahu. So the bystanders hearing Eli, Eli, when he's saying father, father,
yeah,
they automatically think maybe he's calling for Elijah.
Sure.
Which is just so silly.
Right.
Matthew is also, however, exploiting an existing Jewish expectation that Elijah might return. Remember there was that
okay.
way back in.
Right.
So they're like, look at the king of the Jews calling for Elijah.
Because they still set out a seat for him.
Yeah.
You know, like.
Yeah, to this day, they still set out a seat for Elijah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the crowd decides to wait and see whether Elijah will come and rescue Jesus.
Oh.
They don't know he's calling for his father.
Okay.
So that makes that make a little bit more sense.
Sure.
Still weird, yeah, but it does make a little more sense.
Right.
Also, this cry harkens back to Psalms. Psalm 22, specifically, the first two verses go, my God, why have you forsaken me?
Yeah.
Why are you so far from saving me, so far from my cries of anguish? My God, I cry out by day, but you do not answer. By night, but I find no rest.
Right.
So there's that as well. There's sure. lots going on there.
Yeah.
But let's talk about the vinegar for a minute that they gave him. Because okay. we were like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
So when they said vinegar, it actually doesn't mean like vinegar.
Okay.
Okay. It's a dumb word because the Greek term actually refers to a sour wine, and that often gets translated into vinegar in older English Bibles. So that's what we got stuck with.
Okay.
But the Romans and ordinary people drank cheap sour wine. So the scene isn't necessarily about someone finding like some cooking vinegar and then, you know, putting the bottle up under his nose.
Like, yeah.
Here, Jesus, have some fucking vinegar.
Right.
They were actually trying to give him something to drink.
Okay.
So they were trying to help him.
Got it.
I don't know if you recall, but they put the charge, like what he'd been charged with, they put a sign over his head stating the crime. And the sign says, this is Jesus, the King of the Jews.
Oh.
Yeah, that was his charge.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Romans commonly displayed the charge for which a person had been executed. Notably, however, the charge is not that he committed blasphemy or he stole shit or he was a bad hombre.
Right.
It was he's referring to himself as the King of the Jews.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
So that makes it a Roman charge. That makes it political.
Sure.
King, a rival king, potentially challenges Caesar and Roman authority. And even though Pilate knew that he hadn't actually claimed that at all, he's like, if you say so.
They had to have something.
Right.
Right.
So that's one reason that the trial narratives can feel really strange if read only as a religious dispute.
Sure.
Crucifixion, again, was a Roman state execution and not a Hebrew one.
Right.
Jesus is being presented to Pilate in a way that makes him look politically dangerous to force Romans to take care of their problem for them.
Yeah.
Which goes back to what I was saying earlier. They were using Pilate.
Yeah.
To solve their problem.
Right.
So the Roman soldiers that were mocking Jesus, they accidentally kind of became, I don't know, my notes, like where I was getting my notes from, they said that they accidentally became preachers. I don't like that term. They accidentally became people who were ironically or sarcastically fulfilled what they were saying. Like, they dress him as a king.
Yeah.
Like, they put him in a scarlet robe.
Okay.
That's what a king would wear. They put a crown on his head. It's a crown of thorns.
Right, right.
They give him a reed as a fake scepter.
Yeah.
Like, we didn't see that in this one, but apparently at in some point, others, they right. give him a reed.
Okay.
And they're like, here's your scepter, ha ha ha.
Right.
Now you're a real king, right? And then they kneel and they shout, ha ha ha, king of the Jews, ha ha ha. So, like, there's something in that where they are, like, making fun, but they're actually dressing him up as he supposedly really is. Like, we as readers are supposed to be like, you're laughing, but you're the ones that are wrong. You
sure.
horrible people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I can't even believe you.
Right, right.
So Matthew's audience reading this, they know that every single thing that they're saying is quote unquote true.
Right. Yeah. So it's ironic. It's mocking them by what they're mocking him for.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So definitely some irony happening
sure.
there. So the immediate results of Jesus's death, the prodigies that accompanied and followed his death, Jesus gets acknowledged by the centurion as, oh my goodness, you really are the Son of God. What, what? Hmm. And then several women behold the crucifixion and come along, you know, all the Marys,
right?
So I'm going to read verses 51, 2, and 3.
Okay.
At that moment, the curtain, we're going to talk about that, of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook, the rocks split, and the tombs broke open. The bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. We're going to talk about that.
Holy zombies.
Yeah. They came out of the tombs after Jesus' resurrection and went into the holy city and appeared to many people.
Yeah.
All right. So let's talk about the temple curtain.
Okay.
First of all, note that it tears from top to bottom.
Yeah.
Now, somebody in our Discord group, because we do record our chapter readings live on Discord every Tuesday at 10. Join
yeah.
us. 10
yeah.
p.m. Eastern. Tuesdays.
Yeah.
Be there. Pointed out that it was symbolic that it tore from top to bottom. The curtain did. And it turns out that is correct. This is a huge symbolic imagery. The curtain separated the holiest area of the temple from the rest. So the tearing can mean that the tearing itself, I'll get to the top to bottom thing.
Okay.
But the tearing itself is symbolic that access to God is now open. Jesus's death has removed the barrier between humanity and God.
Ah.
The old temple system has been transformed or superseded. A major theme in early Christianity is that Jesus replaces or fulfills the sacrificial system. You know, we've seen that, like, you don't have to sacrifice animals anymore because Jesus was the ultimate sacrifice.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
That kind
yeah.
of thing.
Right.
It also could be symbolic that divine judgment is coming to the temple, which we
right.
know happens. Ha
sure.
ha ha ha.
Yeah.
This is especially relevant because Matthew has already had Jesus predict the temple's destruction, which
but
again,
they wrote it after it had already happened.
Right.
So not a big surprise.
Right. Can you be predicting something that you're writing about as it happens?
No.
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 No, in
That's
fact.
The,
no.
Yeah.
Yeah. So going back to the direction of the tear, it does indeed, as was pointed out by one of our Discord fans, That God did do it because humans tear something from the bottom or the middle. And the temple curtain tearing from above implies a divine action.
Got it.
So I just thought that was interesting because I wasn't particularly looking for that little tidbit. But when it was pointed out, she told us that that's what her church teaches.
Got it.
So, yes, apparently many churches teach that.
Right.
So, cool.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about those fucking bodies, those zombies, right?
This is what I need to know. I need to know about this.
This was my favorite part.
I mean, yeah.
And also, like, freaks me out.
How can you not love Bible zombies?
Well, I'm supposed to take the Bible seriously, right? Like, it really happened. That means zombies are real. Sure. Because these bodies.
Right.
Okay. So, they were actually not ghost zombies or golems. As holy people, they were resurrected saints. That's how they are referred to.
Okay.
So ghosts would generally imply spirits or apparitions.
Yeah.
Matthew specifically says bodies. So they're not ghosts, okay?
Right.
They're not golems either, because golems are artificial. I'm going through here trying to
piece
this together.
I gotcha.
Okay.
Yeah.
Golems are artificially animated beings from much later Jewish folklore. And actually, we did a really cool special episode about golems.
It was a while back.
Was a while back, but worth checking out. It was a really great episode, you guys.
Yeah.
And so then we get left with zombies. So in the sense of dead bodies got up and walked around and, you know, was moving.
Right.
They can be considered zombie adjacent.
Yeah.
We can refer to them that way.
Awesome.
In the sense of mindless undead who eat brains, no, they're not.
Didn't say they didn't eat brains.
It did say that many people saw them. It didn't refer to them screaming in terror and running. Like, we did not see a worldwide epidemic,
right?
You know, pandemic where they're still taking over the world today.
Sure.
Right.
Sure. And there was zero follow-up with this.
Zero follow-up. Yeah. The intended concept is resurrection. They were supposed to be like some holy saints were resurrected. And that is like a precursor to what we're about to see from the biggest fucking resurrection ever.
Right. But like, then what? What happened to these fuckers that got like, you just resurrected a bunch of holy people?
Yep.
And that's it.
That's it. That's the whole story.
Okay.
The other gospels do not include any resurrected saints. Many scholars see this passage as just some apocalyptic symbolism.
Yeah.
Like, whatever, Matthew. You crazy fuck.
Right.
You kooky kid. It's, at the very least, material Matthew uses just to communicate the cosmic meaning of Jesus's death.
Like, I guess.
Matthew invokes a lot of magic in his, like, he goes hard on the angels coming down in dreams. He goes hard on all of the magic stuff that happens. Like, he went hard on, you know, the day turned to night for a few hours, about 3 o'clock.
I just feel like a lot of this just detracts from the story.
It does. Right?
Like, it's like,
let the story stand on its own.
Right.
We don't need symbolism.
Because it's,
but it
honestly,
wasn't
these
for
days,
us.
This just sounds absurd.
Right.
So.
But it wasn't written for us.
Right.
It was written for people who would have appreciated what he meant. And what he meant was, I don't know how else to tell you. This shook up the cosmos, motherfuckers. Let me give you an example of what I mean. And, like, he had to present it and portray it to this specific audience as the cosmos was shaken.
Sure.
And so this was just more of that symbolism to get at what he was trying to convey. It wasn't written for us.
Okay.
That's really hard to keep in mind, but we have to because it's so stupid.
Right.
But his audience didn't think it was stupid.
Sure.
They were like, oh, yeah, I get what you're saying, man. You mean to say that this was a big fucking deal? And he's like, yeah. Finger on nose. Ding, ding, ding. You got it. Winner, chicken dinner.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
So basically, it's the Christians today who read it and don't understand the audience that it was written for and be like, no, it totally happened for realsies. They don't understand. It wasn't written for them. They're not the intended audience.
I guess.
But they're reading it wrong.
Sure.
It didn't really happen.
No, obviously it didn't really happen, but like, it does say that that's what happened. So it is very hard.
But only in Matthew.
It's very hard to dismiss that in so far as people say that the Bible is literally the word of God, right? So like, that's where I call issue on this, or call bullshit on this, because it's like, this is, you're saying these words and you're saying that they happened. So, and there's it's just that you say it and then there's nothing else. Right? Like, right. This is a dramatic statement that you just made. Mm-hmm. And literally, there is zero follow-up on this at all.
No, it's true. I mean, the fact that Matthew places it just casually, he just lays it down in the middle of the crucifixion, no less. Right,
yeah.
Like, that does, I agree with you, make it even stranger than it would already just be as a story by itself.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. Totally. Like,
this is way out there.
It's very out there.
Yeah.
But a lot of Matthew is.
Sure.
And, you know, we could just look at Christians and be like, oh, that's so cute that you don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
Right.
Aw, you don't know anything about your own book. Aw. Like, that's how I prefer to take it.
Yeah.
So then we move into the last bit. We are bringing this home. We're almost done.
All right.
Okay?
Yep.
So the last bit is the burial of Jesus. Jesus is buried by Joseph of Arimathea.
Arimathea.
Arimathea,
yeah,
that guy, Arrhythmia, and the authorities post guards at the tomb.
Yeah.
Okay. So the rich man begs the body of, he begs Pilate for Jesus' dead body.
Yeah.
He sets Jesus' body in his own new tomb, and then the women watch it. The right. Jews consult with Pilate about how they may prevent the resurrection of Jesus, and he grants them a guard for the tomb.
Yeah.
And they seal the stone that stopped the mouth of the tomb where Jesus was laid.
Sure.
And then they set a guard. So the chief priest tells Pilate, Jesus said he would rise again. His disciples might steal the body and then they're going to fucking claim he rose from the dead.
Right.
So Pilate gives them a guard, right?
Yeah.
But the guards at the tomb only appear in Matthew. Matthew also claims that after the resurrection, the guards were bribed to say the disciples stole the body while we were asleep. Remember?
Yeah.
I was like, basically, the Jewish leadership was like, I will pay you to throw yourself under the train, you know, throw yourself under the bus.
Right.
But Matthew then adds, this story has been spread among the Jews to this day. Okay?
Right.
This actually makes a great case suggesting that Matthew was responding to a specific competing explanation for why Jesus's body was allegedly missing.
Right.
He was writing this and created this fucking story to combat stories that were being spread in the time that he was writing it.
Yeah.
About the missing body.
Got it.
Yeah. Matthew was telling us about a real late first century argument. The Christians wrote Jesus rose, and the critics like us are like, his followers obviously stole the body.
Right.
And Matthew's like, no, for real, there were guards, y'all. The other guys didn't write it, but like, there were totally guards, and they were bribed.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this was all a Matthew construction.
Sure.
It really is important that it's included because it's less about what happened there and more about a debate that was already unfolding as Matthew was writing this.
That's funny.
And that is fucking hilarious to me.
Yeah. But it's funny that there was a legitimate explanation for what might have happened to Jesus's body when this was written.
So
when the New Testament was being written, there was a legitimate argument as to why Jesus might not have been in the fucking tomb.
Apparently it wasn't even a story. It was, his body got stolen.
You know what seems like a solid, like, rebuttal to that would be? Is if they could prove that Jesus was still living on the other end of this.
Right.
Which obviously, since they had to have a rebuttal to those arguments, that is not able to be proven either.
Right, exactly.
So, and just insofar as they don't have proof.
That's why his body was stolen.
Right.
Yeah. So, but they were like, no, and it's like, nah. So, another thing that we kind of noted, but only offhandedly, Jesus gets a lot less miraculous the closer and closer he gets to the cross.
Sure. Yeah.
Like earlier, Jesus, he heals instantly. He commands demons. He calms storms. He feeds thousands. He walks on water.
Yeah.
He predicts the future. Like, he does all this magical shit, right?
Right, right.
Like, for the last time, he's a magic man, mama. Right? Yeah,
right.
But the closer he gets to the crucifixion, the less he uses his own power to save himself.
Sure.
And at his arrest, he says he could ask for 12 legions of angels, but yeah, he doesn't.
Right.
And then on the cross, people are like, if you're really God's son, save yourself. He doesn't. And then
I'm assuming he's trying to represent more of humanity at this point.
Like, yeah.
They're trying to portray, like, they showed that this is the Son of God. These are all the things that he can do. And as he's getting closer to this death, he's representing the suffering and the whatever of humanity, I guess.
Right.
So, like, that's how
they wanted it both ways. They wanted him to be both magical but also human.
Right.
And they did a shit job.
They did. They did.
Because, no.
But that's also why they had them crying about dying in the fucking desert by himself or whatever.
Why have you forsaken me? Take this cup from my lips, Dad. So, Matthew's theological answer is not that... Okay. His theological answer is that not saving himself is precisely the point.
Sure.
Narratively, it really creates an extraordinary reversal for people like me and you reading this, because we're like, the guy who claimed to save literally everybody else didn't take a second to save himself.
Right.
And that's just weird and dumb.
Yeah.
The end.
Right. I mean, again, like, he knew he was dying. He was supposed to be sacrificing himself, I guess, for humans. And blah, 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 blah. But, like, this is all manufactured after the fact, right? Like, I mean, this is all with the knowledge that the temple has been destroyed. Mm-hmm. It's all with the knowledge that there are other arguments as to what happened to Jesus. I mean, literally, the guy that bought the tomb that they moved Jesus into was a rich Jew who was a follower of Jesus or something.
Yep.
So, like, even if he had a fucking guard from the Romans out front watching the place, if they had a guard out front watching the place for the Jewish religious people, this guy is a rich dude. Maybe he had a fucking tunnel coming the back way to get him out. Like, right. I mean, there's so many just easy explanations as to why this never would have happened or did happen or whatever. Mm-hmm. And beyond that, this wouldn't even be an argument if there was any proof that he have even resurrected, but we have to take tales of it from, like, a few people. Like, hey, he got resurrected. Like, okay, but, like, what happened to the zombies? What happened to Jesus?
Right.
Where's the other side of the story?
Right.
Where's the resurrection story where he's there and he fucking resurrected?
Exactly.
Like, that's missing. Where the fuck is that bit?
I don't know, but we're going to be reading some other Gospels. Maybe they will answer our questions better.
Sure. I mean, we got the Q&A coming up for 28, and we read 28 already, but, like, and it does say he resurrected, but it's just, like, the women and, like, some of his disciples that see him. Mm-hmm. And then the fucking book ends.
Right.
Like, what? Does he go back? Like, does he go back somewhere? Does he die again? Like, what happened to Jesus?
I don't even
know. Literally, they just stopped the fucking story.
Right.
I'm like, wait. I have questions, guys. Like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
Like, seriously. You still didn't cover the zombies. I need to know more about that.
Never get touched on.
And Jesus
anywhere.
Is kind of a big deal these days out here. So, like, I need more than what you gave me, because that didn't complete. You didn't finish. Somebody stopped writing, guys. I don't know what happened, but it's not done.
It's not done, for sure. Yeah.
Anyway, that's all you got?
That's all I got.
That's all you got. Okay.
That's so enough. Wasn't that enough?
It was great. It was great. That was Matthew chapter 27 Q&A.
Sure as fuck was.
And we will be back next time with...
Matthew 28 Q&A.
That's right. All right. We'll see you then.
Bye.
Hey, wife, I guess that's the end?
But husband, that's just sad.
It doesn't have to be. We are on lots of social media platforms like Twitter. Our handle there is sacrilegious_D.
For D's nuts.
Oh my God. Stop doing that. Anyway, we're also on Facebook, Instagram, and Pinterest. There's a link to all of our social media sites at our website.
Ooh, we have a website?
Yeah, it's sacrilegiousdiscourse.com, where you can also find a link to our merch shop.
We have a merch shop?
Yep. We have podcast-themed clothing, mugs, notebooks, and more, as well as an atheist and science-themed products.
Wow, our fans should really go check that out right now.
Definitely. They can get in touch with us by sending an email to sacrilegiousdiscourse@gmail.com. But before they do that, we could really use some help.
Oh yeah? With what?
Well, it's not free running the podcast, and we need some financial support in order to get better equipment, which will free up time so we can concentrate on our podcast and our fans.
Okay, so what should they do?
Head over to patreon.com/sacrilegiousdiscourse and sign up as a contributor on our podcast. Supporters there receive additional bi-weekly episodes that we record just for our Patreon members for as little as $2 a month.
Also, we'd really appreciate it if you would like and subscribe on whatever platform you're using.
And Apple Podcast reviews help us out tremendously.
Like and subscribe. Leave an Apple review. Join us on Twitter. Support us on Patreon. That's a lot of instructions. Don't forget to say thanks.
Thanks.
Okay, bye.